This is the Level Up Podcast. I'm Taylor Petrinovich.
And I'm Kelly Gilster of 618 Studios.
And we are on a mission to help filmmakers level up their businesses and their craft so they can make more and work less.
We want to help you confidently take your business from mainstream to luxury, and it all starts right here.
Well, hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for another podcast episode. I am here with my girl, Taylor.
Hey, guys.
And I'm here with a few other friends. We have some really awesome filmmakers here joining us who are alumni of our mastermind program. We are doing a live podcast recording with them here with us. We're also doing a Q&A format. So we're going to be doing some really fun things on this episode, something different that we've never done before. And Taylor, I'm excited about it. Are you excited about it?
I'm really excited. I love trying new things, and I think it's time for a little bit of fresh blood for the podcast. So this morning, also we're very last minute, guys. So this morning we put out a call for questions, both on Instagram. If you don't follow us already, we're at the Level Up Co. And in our Facebook group, which again, we would love to have you join us there. For filmmakers and photographers to just kind of ask us anything. And we got some really great questions, and we can't wait to answer those with you guys and get kind of our alumni's perspective as well. And then at the end, we're going to open it up to our alumni to ask questions as well. So that's going to be really fun.
Yes, we would love to just keep this community growing, whether it's on Instagram or a Facebook group. It's just a fun place. We keep it really positive. It's a great community. We absolutely love it. And we'd love to have you a part of it as well. So Taylor, I think we should just dive right in. We have so many questions, so many good questions, that I really feel like this could be five different podcast episodes. And we're going to focus specifically on a few of our favorites. There were so many, and we're still kind of deciding like how we want to roll out these next few questions, the ones that we didn't get to. So stay tuned. If your question didn't get answered in this recording, it will be answered at some point down the road. So be sure that you're tuning in, listening in, and hear your question answered.
Yeah, we love opening up like to questions to the community, because I think that other people just have questions that they want to ask that we never really thought about before. So it's great to learn from our peers and to really like kind of keep our eyes and ears open of what other people are talking about, because we can kind of get in our little, you know, tunnel vision where we only think and act one way. And it's really helpful to kind of hear how other people are doing things, what they're considering, and things like that. So learning from other people is just a great way to improve on business. So without further ado, we're just going to dive right in. So the first question was from our Facebook group. This is from Leslie Sotelo of Leslie Margarita Photography. And she asked, should you still raise your prices if the demand isn't there? Which is such a great question.
Yes, I specifically love this question because there's been so much chatter in other Facebook groups, in our own Facebook group, that 2024 is feeling a little bit slower than, you know, as far as bookings are going. And so it can be scary to make those annual price adjustments when you're feeling like your demand has decreased. I think that specifically this is something that needs to be looked at year by year and seen. You know, I've talked about it myself. You know, I have a specific method on when I raise my prices during, you know, that year. And it's typically when I've booked a certain amount of weddings for that year. And then I want to fill out the remainder of that year with almost basically the pricing for next year, because we all kind of hit that point in our year where we're booking both 2023 and 2024 clients, or 2024 and 2025 clients. And so you don't want to get stuck with 2025, you know, clients paying your 2024 rates. So I think that looking at how your year has kind of been building, then you can make those decisions to make price increases. And I will say, I don't know if this is true for you, Taylor, but I have never really done the same set amount of price increases. I have made larger jumps sometimes. I've made smaller jumps sometimes. I've been happy with where I'm at in the market that I'm serving, and I didn't raise my rates too much for the following year. I've done like a myriad of different things. What about you?
Yeah, I definitely don't follow like a cut and dry way of doing things either. And I also think it's important to note that although we are champions of raising your prices, charging your worth, growing within the industry, I think it's really important to not overlook that you need to be improving upon some area of your business or your craft in order to elicit that price increase and to do it successfully. So whether that means, you know, a rebrand where your kind of your value from your brand is increased, or your craft has made like a huge jump, like you've really, really improved, or your relationships now will allow for those higher prices. Like something has to change. You can't just continue doing the same thing over and over and over again and just be raising your prices. Like that doesn't really make sense. Something needs to grow, something needs to change in order for it to be successful. So I mean, that's like the heart behind this podcast and our Instagram and our mastermind program. Like we really want to help people make those changes, active changes in their businesses so that they can raise their prices. Like we're not just giving like blind advice, like raise your prices for no reason. I think that's doing a disservice to people actually. So it's very situational.
Yes. Second question also came from our Facebook group. Forgive me if I pronounce this wrong, either Mara or Maya Shields. She asked, and it's kind of a long one, but I absolutely love this question. And maybe I can kind of condense a little bit. It's specifically about second shooters. So she said, you know, I think Kelly mentioned that she always shoots with her husband. Yes, that's true. We're a husband and wife team. We shoot every single event together. Taylor, she does bring on second shooters. This probably is like a really good, you know, question for her specifically. And she said, how do you hire second shooters and how do you find and train them up to your standards, your brand standards, what you want to showcase on a wedding day, you know, without coming across too controlling? So Taylor, do you give feedback? Do you give criticism? How do you prep those second shooters to know that they're going to be a great extension of your brand?
Yes. So this is like a multi-part answer. I would say, number one, we actually just had Peyton Frank speak in our mastermind program, literally just this morning. So this is all still very fresh. And one of our mastermind students in there asked a question about her process for hiring second shooters. And mine is very similar. So I'm always hiring someone at like a pretty similar level to myself. So they own their own businesses. They are lead shooters for their own companies. Like they do it all themselves also. So there's not a lot of handholding when it comes to my second shooters and like how I'm like quote unquote training them. That's not really a thing for me. But I will give feedback. Like, so everyone has their strengths and weaknesses. And as much as I try to bring people on to like play to their strengths and also to play to my weaknesses, like for them to fill that gap, like sometimes that's not possible. So I will give guidance. Like I'll say like, hey, I know your general style or your general way of doing things is ABC, but like I prefer an XYZ method. And it's just like a really open conversation. If you bring on the right people, like who second shoot often or like who are open to those like kinds of feedback or like they want to grow, like they're gonna want to do things to like please you and to like create a good product for you. So most of the time they're really, really open to feedback and they want to do a good job. Like they're there getting paid too and building a relationship with you as well. So I think it just helps them in their own business to do a good job, right? So I'm always like open with communication, but actually Kelly and I, this is like a little like sneak peek for you guys. We're actually working on a brand new item for our shop, which is going to be a second shooter guide. So we're compiling this PDF where we already are going to include a ton of information, but it's going to be editable on Canva in case you want to go in and add your own little nuances for your own business and how you want your second shooters to execute the day or what you want them to wear or things like that. So that's just like a really easy thing to like hand over where it's very like comprehensive on how you want to operate. But that's another thing too. I am always like giving my second shooters a dress code. So it more than likely it's a male and I'll say, please wear a suit. So I think like just being really upfront and honest and communicate, like those are the three keys.
Yeah. Oh, we have our first question from alumni Gabrielle. Gabrielle, introduce yourself real quickly, and I'd love to hear what you'd love to either ask an additional question or, you know, provide some more, you know, more answers to this question.
Hi, everybody. This is Gabrielle of Gabrielle Fordham. I had something to add because for me this year, I had more new second shooters than I've ever had in my business before, which was unique. And I found vetting them on a video call was super helpful to understand someone's personality and just like their natural way of shooting. I would try to ask questions like, if you were going to shoot cocktail hour, what would be the three things you're looking for? Just to try to understand what their natural perspective is. And from that, if I could train them or if we were looking for similar things naturally, because most of us probably don't have like hours and hours and hours of time to train someone that's really new to you from the start. So it's nice to have someone that really like aligns with your vision and sort of like is at least close to your perspective as a filmmaker. So that was super helpful for me.
Yeah, personality is a big thing too. Like you want to see if they're going to kind of jive with you, if they're professional, like kind of what their demeanor is like, because sometimes that can be something that makes them be a good fit or not a good fit as well. So that's really smart.
Yes, I love that you brought that up, Gabrielle. So thank you for adding that into the mix of answers for her. Our third question, Taylor, do you feel like we covered that one all pretty well?
I feel like, can we get like a thumbs up, thumbs down from the
thumbs up? If you guys are watching on YouTube, you get to see all of these sweet little faces and our thumbs up and thumbs down. I think Bruce just gave a fist bump. That's cool. awesome. Okay. So Malok Media, I believe Taylor, you said his name is Trevor.
I think that's Trevor. Yes.
Trevor with Malok Media. He wanted to know, how do you write good and captivating copy on Instagram posts? I love this question because this can be such an afterthought for so many filmmakers, right? We maybe pour in a good amount of time in writing copy on our websites or, you know, our collections page or proposals that we're sending out. But when it comes to Instagram, it can be really easy to think that these words don't matter, and they absolutely do matter. Taylor, you and I were talking a little bit about this earlier this morning, and you had some really great insight into this.
Yes. So I would say a mistake I see being made all the time is to kind of waste that opportunity and write like a really boring, mundane caption. So gone are the days of saying Amanda and Mike got married on a beautiful Saturday at the so-and-so venue, and it was such an honor to capture their day. Like, no, thank you. Please do not do that. This is an opportunity to like really showcase your brand and your brand voice and what makes you unique and how you're perceiving the day and what you want your potential clients, as well as like other creative partners who follow you on Instagram, to perceive you. So always keeping that brand voice in mind. So whether that be like really classic and romantic, or my brand is a little bit more like quippy and sarcastic at times, or whatever it may be, like really keeping that brand voice in mind, and then treating it like we're back in English class and we're going to use the concept of drafts, right? You're going to write your rough draft to get all your ideas down, and you're going to go through and refine and look at a thesaurus and find better verbiage and gain inspiration. And it's okay to sit on a caption for a couple of days before you post it, or pre-plan your captions. Like maybe, you know, you want to talk about a couple of different things and you have like them in your notes app, ready to go whenever you may have a post or a reel that fits with like the topic at hand. Several episodes ago, like I'm talking like 2 years ago, maybe, I had my friend Ashley Baumgartner, who's a photographer, on, and I think she's like really eloquent when it comes to writing. And she talked all about writing Instagram captions. And so you guys can go back and find that if you want. But she had like a really great point of instead of looking at the wedding day as like this big picture, like choose like one little thing. So let's say you're sharing a little moment from the ceremony or the ceremony decor, like talk about, like zone in as far as you can, like through a magnifying glass on like one thing you want to talk about. Is it the florals? Is it the aisle? Is it the way the groom was looking at the bride, like find like kind of a micro moment and then like start to like build outwards, right? So like you can talk about different things, interject like how you're an expert or like build trust through your caption. All of these things are great opportunities to use Instagram wisely instead of just saying so-and-so got married. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. Also like, you know, inviting those to share what they really liked. So giving them a prompt of some kind, I think is a really smart move. You know, asking, you know, I love, you know, like what's your favorite guest experience about this wedding? You know, I loved the oyster station that they had at cocktail hour or whatever it may be. You know, something, you know, maybe you're showing a tablescape of some kind and being like, there were so many intricate details. What is your favorite part of this design? You know, things like that to, you know, bring in some more comments, some conversations. I know we all love comments on our films, and it's really good to be able to prompt your audience to welcome them into that conversation. One other thing too that is absolutely so, so important is I see a very common mistake amongst photographers. Not as much on photographers. I feel like they almost get it a little bit more, but filmmakers especially are a little bit behind on, you need to credit the entire creative team or the vendor team that was a part of that wedding day or wedding weekend. So what this looks like is writing out, you know, your eloquent caption or quippy caption, whatever fits your brand voice. And then below, you know, naming everyone out, naming the venue, the planner, the florist, the stationery designer, the dress, all this stuff. We have a questionnaire that I send out to all of my clients. It's also in our shop. And one of the questions is on there where the planner or the client can pre-fill in who is a part of, you know, it's all pre-filled in. So like lighting, like you're not going to miss anybody really because it's all in there. And then they can just basically plug in the creative partner based on that, you know, niche or whatever they have going on. So make sure that you're pulling from that, that you have that information, and that you're constantly crediting not just the first time you share that wedding, but maybe it's a really great portfolio piece and you're sharing it 3 months later, 6 months later, a year later. Everybody still needs to be involved. I think all of us have felt that feeling of not being credited, you know, either through the florist or whatever. We get left out maybe as filmmakers. And it doesn't feel good. So let's make sure that we are really setting the precedent that there's a united front here. There was a huge team behind this beautiful event, and everyone deserves credit the first time to the last time you share on social media.
I have two quick little things to add to. Number one, put yourself in the credit list. Say like if you're a filmmaker, sometimes like if we're crediting everyone, we kind of forget to put ourselves. But a lot of times, if this is like the first time somebody else is posting this event, they're just going to go and copy and paste somebody else's credits. So you want to make sure you put yourself in there too, so that they're not copy and pasting without you. So that's just a little hack. And then number two, I actually have been seeing a lot about how Instagram is moving away from hashtags and more to keywords. So the more keywords that you want to be like, you know, ranking for on Instagram, like incorporating those mindfully into your captions as well is really, really smart. So that's a great time to like talk about like how, as a filmmaker or as a photographer, you know what I mean? Like using these terms like intentionally is going to help you be seen a little bit.
Miranda, we have Miranda here that has something to add or an additional question. Go ahead and introduce yourself to listeners.
Hi, I'm Miranda with Rosemary Films. I just had a question about how diligent to be about caption tagging versus like tagging them up in the post. Should we be just as thorough with like the actual tag, or is the caption kind of like what people are looking for?
I like to do both. Taylor, what do you do?
Every time I always list them all out in the caption. And then I actually sometimes am not actually tagging every single person every single time. For example, let's say there's something like the bathroom rentals or something like that. Like I may not tag them, but I am always listing them, if that makes sense. It's also really important. We've talked about this in our mastermind before, but I think this may be the first time we're talking about this on the podcast, is when you get into multi-day events also, it's really smart to separate out like how you're posting on Instagram. So maybe not blending the two or multiple days into one post, because there's going to be different vendor teams for each day. It's going to be a different venue, sometimes a different florist, most of the time a different caterer. So like keeping those things in mind too, there's kind of a lot to think about, but the more you're being mindful of those things, like it'll save you from getting kind of like a DM being like, hey, just so you know, you know, that's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Miranda, do you have a follow-up too?
Yeah, I have one more question. This is something I'm kind of working through. What's your take on tagging your second shooter, and what's your take on like verbiage on like what to call them?
This is such a good question, because I have also seen this time and time again. I'm not sure if I have a major opinion. I feel like I see it a little bit more when that filmmaker or photographer that might be like either their exclusive second shooter or someone that's like just in their top four of people that they use. I think that it's great if you want to tag your second shooter. I don't think that it's always necessary. It's like, it's a nice thing to do. Taylor, what are your thoughts? I feel like I didn't answer that super well.
No, I feel like it's good. I think this is one of those things where people want like a straight answer, but it's very like kind of anything goes. I don't tag my second shooter in posts, but a lot of the times I'll tag them in stories, like especially like if they're traveling to me, like I'll tag them, or if we go out to eat, or if I'm like doing behind the scenes of the wedding day, like I'll tag, you know what I mean? Like there's like different things like that on stories that I'll generally do. And I'm going to be totally honest. It's more often that I tag a second shooter if I see them as an in alignment with my brand too. So sometimes like we'll use people based off of who's available or location or things like that. And you may not have similar brands who like speak to similar people in the same way. And so I am generally mindful of like public alignment, if that makes sense. As harsh as that may sound, it is kind of the reality. So that's my honest answer.
I think that's great. Cool. I think we got that one all covered. Let me look at my next one. These are all so good. I'm so glad that all of you participated. Again, I wish we could get to all of these. And honestly, I'm looking through some of these and they could be like rapid fire things too. So the next one here I have is Danielle Mays. How do people do same day edits? I've seen filmmakers offer amazing edits the day of the wedding, and I would love to know more about the logistics of how they make that happen. I'm going to be first to say that I have never offered same day edits. And same day edits were a huge thing when we first started into the industry. So in 2009, we were seeing them a lot, 2010, 2011, 12, 13, like they were a big deal. I think now just with Instagram, and people being able to like almost instantly share too, like the following day or 2 days later, I almost feel like it's kind of taken the place of the same day edit. We rarely get, you know, people asking about same day edits. Taylor, what about you?
Yeah. So just to kind of like elaborate a little bit more, like I think it used to be like you're delivering a 4-minute film same day. Like you're like having someone during the reception feverishly edit in the back room and then delivering their entire film to them. And I think that it has changed and it's more of a social media teaser. I have done a few same day edits where it's kind of the workflow for me has been having somebody constantly dumping cards and backing up cards so that I have like two like sets of like all of my files before I ever like open anything in an editing app. And what it looks like for me is like very aesthetic. It's no story. Sometimes no audio. It's like literally choosing like those eye candy shots and like calling it a day. And we've also seen a lot of people. So you'll hear so many different opinions about this. And this is really like feeling it out on where you're at in the industry and where you want to go, you know, dressing for the job you want, like, so to speak. And some people will, you know, show these same day edits on a laptop and have that set up on, you know, a high table during like open dancing. And some people will like stop the reception and show it on a big screen. And, you know what I mean? There's all these different ways to do it. And Kelly and I kind of, we agree that, we don't necessarily think it's like the best, you know, client or guest experience to be like stopping the festivities, like to showcase your work. We see that as a little bit self-serving as like filmmakers and not like having the client's best interest in mind. And so I've done a lot of delivering of my teasers, like in the wee hours of that next day, that Sunday morning. So they're waking up to seeing the content. But I edited it the night before, if that makes sense. But I'm kind of moving away from that, and I don't know if I'm just being lazy or if I'm like sitting on content a little bit longer before I want to edit it or what. But it's generally a few days now for me. So for those of you who are like, oh my God, it's making my skin crawl thinking about trying to edit the same day, like, please know this is not the expectation. You do not need to do that if you don't want to, but sometimes we know content can be really exciting and fun and you might want to. So by all means.
Yeah. Yeah. And Taylor and I are always huge advocates on do what fulfills you, do what sounds fun to you. Don't offer services that don't sound fun to you. So some people just like, you know, back in the day, you know, I would hear different companies saying like, oh my gosh, the thrill of a same day edit is something that I live for. And I say more power to them, because to me, I'm about to break out in hives thinking about offering a same day edit. I think the most we've ever done is a next day edit, and it was a 4-day Indian wedding. So I had time each day at the end of each day to kind of slowly build onto that story. And then they wanted to showcase it. They wanted it to be a part of one of their reception experiences. And so, yeah, we went ahead and delivered it, and they played it on like these built-in screens that were already a part of their ballroom. But yeah, we've never done a same day edit, and maybe we have turned away. I'm sure we have not been chosen because we don't offer same day edits way back in the day. And that's okay, because we always kind of felt like our ideal client wasn't the same day edit type of client. And I think that it's important to really remain true, to your ideal client and the brand, and not feel pulled in different directions just to try to serve a client that wants something and serve another client that wants the other thing, just really remaining true to what you value as a filmmaker or a photographer.
Mm-hmm. Kelly has like a really great analogy. We're not going to get too deep into it because it's going to be a whole future podcast episode, but just imagine a 1-year-old frantically trying to pop as many bubbles as they can. And we're going to leave it at that. Take that visual.
Yep.
We'll expand later. So our next question is by Lizzie Strutman, and she asked, to shoot log or not to shoot log in luxury? And Kelly, what's our answer?
I personally do not shoot log. Taylor does not shoot log. If you want to shoot log, I would say log is a method that is for more of an advanced colorist. Many of you kind of know that I created Alum LUTs, and I do various test edits for people that are interested in, you know, our product. And far too often I am color grading filmmakers who are filming log that are also saying, I don't really know what I'm doing. I've only been filming for a year or for 2 years. And they're just making their lives so much more complicated. I think that like there are people out there that do like shoot on log and then produce incredible colors after the fact. And I'm so refreshed actually when I receive a test edit and I'll say to my husband, Paul, oh my gosh, it's someone that really knows and understands how to film in log, and they understand lighting, and there's so much more in, you know, it's so much more in depth than you think. And so I would just really encourage people, don't just shoot log because someone on a Facebook group told you to shoot it or someone on YouTube told you that that's the only way, because you can have a thriving business in the luxury market and not shoot log. I know many other filmmakers that are starting at $25,000 that have done events upwards of $70,000 that don't shoot log. So don't feel the pressure to film and log just because you're raising your rates. It's not something that is like a, because you charge five figures, you have to shoot and log. It's not true.
Well said. Evan is raising his hand. Evan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello. Yes, I am Evan from Evan Reese Films. So I just wanted to chime in as someone who does currently shoot log. It is absolutely up to you, just like you guys said. I guess my response is more geared towards someone who's on the point where they're kind of teetering, like, should I do it? Should I not? Should I just keep it? So for a really long time, I was shooting in standard profile, and people would literally be like, oh my gosh, are you shooting in like crazy settings? I'm like, nope, literally just standard. So you can totally get amazing content with a standard profile. But if you personally want to get to the point where it's almost like for yourself, because a couple is not going to be able to tell a difference, if we're being honest. It's kind of like a pride thing as a creative yourself. Just a couple little like points of advice if you're first starting out. There is a base ISO level. Don't go under that because you're going to have lots of crazy noise. You want to figure out what your camera's base ISO level is. And one good like strategy to have is overshoot a little bit so that your camera can get the shadows in the log without introducing too much noise in post when you're color grading. So maybe overexpose just a tiny bit to get those shadows looking good. And then when you're actually in the color grade, use a base log LUT first. There's a bunch of really great LUT purchasing websites that you can buy like your specific camera's base conversion LUT. And then once you have that on, you can go into the creative color setting and add your creative LUT, like your Kelly's Loom LUTs. And I use Gamut IOs for mine.
Yeah. And Gamut has a lot. I always point people to Gamut if they are looking for a base LUT. They've done a really amazing job using, you know, a good neutralizer. So you're neutralizing your footage back, and all really good points, Evan. That's awesome. I learned so much because I'm not a lot, like I know how to color grade log, but because I've never done it before, I'm like so lost on all of that stuff. So, that's really helpful. I think that's going to help a lot of the listeners. And just, again, I'm just going to say, like, do what's good for your workflow. Like if you enjoy that, if you enjoy the color grading process, it's going to extend your color grading process a little bit longer. A little bit more TLC is going to be required rather than if you shoot in like a standard neutral profile. So do what makes sense for your post-production workflow. No hate on anyone who films in log, and no hate for anyone that films in neutral. We're all friends. We're all on the same team. So I'm glad that question was asked. And Miranda has her hand up. Miranda, I'd love to hear what you have to say.
This is another like to each their own, but are you guys delivering in 1080 or 4K? And when it comes to teasers, I found that when I deliver that in 4K, Instagram just does not handle that well. So I feel like I have to deliver in 1080, but I feel like in some of my verbiage, I've promised 4K. So like, what's your guys' take on that?
My contract says it will be delivered in a minimum of 1080p. I generally am delivering all deliverables in 4K, which makes my skin crawl because Canon files are huge and my internet sucks and it takes so long to upload it, but I just do. That's just something that I do now. But for the longest time, I shot everything in 4K and delivered everything in 1080, which I feel like is also probably acceptable. Kelly doesn't shoot everything in 4K.
Okay, well,
outed.
I am outed. And I want to talk about why. You guys, I just started. This is another thing, guys, where like in the luxury market, it's less about your gear. It's less about what, like what you film in. Like if we really want to like get people like up in arms, like we could even talk about like cranking your shutter, which I guess I just won't go there, but whatever.
Auto white balance, all the things for me.
Oh my gosh. People are going to die. They're going to be like, I'm unsubscribing from this podcast immediately. No, but like we want to open people's eyes up to this because so many people get stuck in the, you know, nitty gritty of all these things. And this is why it just points to relationships, relationships, relationships. But I just started delivering in 4K this year. And I will say, because in next year, I will be delivering in 4K every wedding. This year I only chose to shoot in 4K on the weddings that I knew that were portfolio pieces for us, because in my contract, I said 1080 and I decided in the beginning of 2023 that I really did need to make the move, mainly because I decided all of our, videos would be formatted now vertically in Instagram, and 1080 was not cutting it in the vertical like idea. So, or realm. So I mainly just did it so that it would look better on Instagram, filming in 4K. But I would say it was maybe half and half on ones that I filmed in 4K and ones that I still filmed in 1080, because I knew that they weren't going to be portfolio pieces that I'd be putting onto my Instagram. A few times I would like to, you know, I would, if I'm like, oh, this one's okay, it's better than I thought showing up, even though we'd committed to like, we're just going to shoot in 1080 this time. I filmed a few shots vertically in order, like 1080 vertically. And then I put together like a little 15 to 20 second teaser just with those vertical shots. But that's where I'm outed on the 4K. You can welcome me to the 4K club officially next year. And that's all. Two questions here. Michael, you haven't asked a question yet or added anything, so go ahead and introduce yourself.
All right. Hello, everybody. I'm Michael Flack of Flack Productions, student to be J. Michael Wedding Films. I have a rebrand just getting ready to launch in a few weeks here. So going back to something we discussed earlier, second shooters, but the other side of it. What's a good way to get in front of filmmakers that are already established in the luxury market and offer yourself up to second shoot for them to start getting the experience of being, you know, on those types of events?
This is such a great question. And I also want to direct this question back to a previous podcast that we had of Daniel Shackelford with Daniel Shackelford Films, where he spoke directly to just the art of second shooting and how much value it can bring to your business. He already has an incredibly thriving business, but he second shoots for some of the top filmmakers in the country. And he does it because it's a great learning opportunity for him too, to learn different things, you know, be able to dip his toes into levels of events that he has never been a part of, and just familiarize yourself with the production level of all of that. He, in the podcast episode, talked about he had an opportunity. So his wife is a wedding photographer. They have two separate companies. I love pointing to them as an example of, if you offer photo and video, how to do it really well, because they do it really well. And so he was second shooting with his wife, and he knew that this filmmaker who he really, really looked up to was going to be on this wedding. And, you know, he looked for a way to, you know, he wanted to make sure that he was conducting himself, you know, in the room really well with him and things like that. And then I believe, Taylor, was it after the wedding that he approached him, or was it like at the end of the night, like at dinner, they were talking about it?
I'm going to be honest, I can't even remember the story. You have a better memory than me, I think.
Okay.
I wish I could help.
Yeah. So at some point he just approached the filmmaker and just said, I look up to you so much. I am so in awe of the events that you do. I would love to be considered to be added to your team as a second or a third. If you have, you know, an opportunity for me where you feel like I would be a great fit. And he took him up on that offer, and now they shoot just the most insane weddings together. And then Daniel has his own weddings that he does that are also equally incredible. So Michael, I would say, you know, maybe anytime that you're able to be like in the room, like with that filmmaker or someone, and if that's not an opportunity for you, then just kind of, like I said, it's almost like starting with, you know, how we talk about in Mastermind on how we develop those planner relationships, where it starts, where we lead it into, things like that, starting, you know, starting on social media and then, you know, going from there. So I really do feel like second shooting can be such a huge growth opportunity for your own business too.
Yeah. And I would say it's very similar to targeting planners in that you probably don't want to target second shooters who are like miles ahead of you, or, you know, 2 second shoot targeting filmmakers who are miles ahead of you, like maybe not reaching out like to someone like Peyton Frank, like on day one, you know what I mean? Like maybe aim for people who are like just a little bit ahead of you. And then you can kind of use them as like testimonials and like to show proof, you know, like, cause then when you do want to climb the ladder of who you want to second shoot for, you can be able to say like, oh, well, I second shot for this person that you already know. And they can like tell you about their experience with me. Like, I think that's probably the best way to do it. And I will say, so I just did a wedding in Dallas a few months ago, and I could not find somebody, you guys. So I put out a call to find second shooters in like a couple of Facebook groups, and I got, you know, flooded with DMs as you do. And, but one stood out to me, and it was like how incredibly professional and like buttoned up his process was. He sent me like a really beautiful introduction, like, hey, here's like about my business, here's my portfolio, and here's a link to schedule a Zoom meeting with me. And I was all, I didn't even talk to anybody else. I was all done. You're like, you made it so easy. And that's who I booked, and it was great. So I will say like have a process that makes it really easy for people, the same way we want to have a process that's really easy for planners and for clients too. You know, they're your client in this situation. So, just something to keep in mind.
Yeah. And then Evan, did you have a question as well?
It was just another comment for the 4K conversation.
You guys are... All right. Let's bring it back.
Yeah. You guys open up the can of worms with all that talk. I'm a big gear person. But it's just a little tip, something that you can do to still film in 1080, but deliver in 4K is after you're done with your export. Or after you're done editing your project, when you go to the export tab, you can literally export the 1080 timeline or sequence in 4K. So
it's
just a little sneaky little tidbit that I do that for all of mine. And I shoot in 1080 all day long, and then I send a video that's in 4K afterwards.
Wow.
There were air quotes there for those of you who are not on YouTube.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it technically still is 4K because it exports it and it just upscales it, and literally no one can tell the difference. It still looks great. So.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Cool. I mean, honestly, like clients cannot tell the difference, you guys, between like 1080 and 4K. It's really just us being hard on ourselves and again getting into the nitty gritty of our gear and processes and things like that. So.
Yeah. All right, we're going to dive into our last question from our Facebook group, and then we have a few minutes for our alumni to ask questions if they have one prepared. So this one is from Cassie Hyatt, who, you guys, she has been editing our podcast for the last several months. I've been saving our butts because we were editing our own podcast for the longest time, and we decided that we could not do it anymore. It was just too much. So Cassie has been saving us. She is the reason this podcast exists. So round of applause for Cassie. Thank you so much. And here's her question. How many films do you recommend having on your portfolio page, and what lengths? I feel like not many videographers have all of their films public, and sometimes they just have 2-minute versions on their site. So we have like an entire module about your portfolio in our course, Luxury Filmmaker Framework, and we recommend a range of films. So it's not always going to be the same for everyone, but like anyone, I would say like, what's the bare minimum, like 4 to 8, like if they're
no more than really, 8, you guys. Yeah. I think like Yeah, I think sweet spot when I've been doing one-on-one mentorships that we offer throughout the year, when we don't have the doors open for mastermind or have a current program running, I always kind of look and see and think that you can really get across your craft well in 6-ish films, right? And so, but if you have 8 really great ones to showcase, show 8. If you have 4 that fit your ideal client the best, show 4. We have a future podcast episode coming out in the weeks to come about how being slightly selfish in your business isn't necessarily a bad thing, and how that's looking is really not, you don't have to show every single wedding that you ever shoot. I don't show every single wedding that I ever shoot. Taylor doesn't. I'm sure a lot of people here in this alumni group here don't either. And, we really just want to be putting out our best work and the work that's going to scale our business to new tiers within the market and those that bring us more of our ideal clients. So we'll get more into that in a future episode. I'm really excited for that one. But she said something really interesting that I wanted to, Taylor, you and I talk about, which is she said, you know, sometimes I'm seeing these filmmakers that are putting on their portfolio like 2-minute films. Why do you think that would be an example of something where they would only show 2 minutes of that rather than, you know, maybe a full 5-minute or even 10-minute film?
Yeah. So I think there's several reasons that it could be, depending on the filmmaker. Number one, they might have some sort of gag order or NDA where they can't show certain things. Maybe there's no audio, certain faces are not allowed. So they're kind of editing around that to have something that they're allowed to share publicly. That's very common. And then another reason to showcase a shorter film is because you can really curate it to be exactly what you want to show. So there's a lot of times where you will have the opportunity to film or photograph a wedding where maybe a portion of it is like worthy or on brand of showcasing online. But the rest is maybe less than ideal. And there's no rule that says you have to show everything online. Like you can be the, like make that decision for yourself. Like that's the beauty of owning your own business and not being tied to a specific set of rules is you do whatever you want. Right. So, I've done this in the past as well, where I had, you know, an 8-minute film and I pared it down to 1.5 minutes because that's all I really wanted to show online. Like nobody needed to see the rest. That was between me and the client.
And if we have photographers listening in on this, I mean, I feel like you all were the early adopters of this, and us as filmmakers felt the need to always showcase these, what we delivered to the client. If you think about it, those photographers who are listening, and actually I'm so excited because we have a lot of photographers in this current mastermind group, which is so cool. And they, you know, when you look at their portfolio, they've already they're not showing you the complete gallery. Right? Every single, you know, hundreds or thousands of photos that the client received, you're seeing, you know, even a curated form of that. And then you're seeing an even more curated form on their Instagram, right? They're showing like the real highlight reel of that gallery. And so I think it's important to realize that the content that you're putting out there should serve the consumer on what they want to be, you know, how they want to be interacting and what they want to see. So like no more putting full length films on your Instagram account, right? Because that's not what Instagram is there for. That's not what a consumer for Instagram is looking. They're looking to consume a 1-minute or less film, not an 8-minute film. Whereas that might be more appropriate on a Vimeo platform or a YouTube platform or whatever it may be. So it's definitely a platform thing too. When you start to see, you know, how in depth people are getting with stories and things like that, being more strategic about, you know, showcasing and serving your consumer based on the platform where they are consuming your work. Evan, you have a follow-up, I believe. I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yes. So this is actually a great segue to what my question was going to be, in regards to portfolio stuff, segueing into pricing. So when you're finally ready to get to the point where you want to be in the high end market, at what point do you, well, I guess a better way to put it, is it best to do a gradual price increase if your brand is where it needs to be? but like for me personally, I have shot more lovely style weddings. I don't think I've had one that's like super high end to showcase in my portfolio. So once my branding is ready to go, do you think it would be smart to gradually increase my prices to get them where I want to be? Or is it more of like a, I know I want to be a luxury wedding filmmaker, I'm just going to go for it?
This like super depends, honestly. First of all, I would say it depends on what your definitions of like slow increases versus like a big jump would be. Like, is a slow increase like $1,000? I mean, $100 and a big jump $1,000? Or are we talking like $10,000? You know what I mean? Like, there's like so much nuance. And then also like it really depends on your situation. So like I've been very open in talking about how like my husband has like a really wonderful full-time job and that provides for our family, and my business is for fun and to pay for extras. And so I have a really high like propensity for risk, right? Like, it's not going to hurt me and my family if I like don't book anybody because I took a big risk. But if somebody listening to this is, you know, the breadwinner for their family, like we would probably advise against like a huge risk like that. Like if this is your full-time gig, right? So I would say it really depends on what you're willing to miss out on just in case that happens. But like we were talking about before, like raising your prices requires all these things. So if you do feel like genuinely feel unbiasedly feel like you have all of your ducks in a row, like you really put in the work, then you probably could raise them more than like just a little bit. Right. Kelly, do you have anything to add?
No, I think that that's perfect. I love that you brought that up because each of our, you know, we talk a lot about running our businesses, but how you run your business needs to be in alignment with just your personal life, right? What does that look like? You know, are you a single, you know, 32-year-old guy that like, you know, you maybe don't have high expenses, or are you someone who is the primary, you know, breadwinner for your family and you have three young kids? Like, there's so many things that go into play on, you know, how these price increases happen, the risk that you're able to make these large jumps. I would say though that like, you know, one thing, and we talked about this on a past episode, but I don't love when people go into it and make these huge jumps and then get scared and retract back. I think that that can be, I almost think that that's more detrimental to the overall brand, because that just starts to kind of set a precedent either to maybe planners who know that like, oh, like these are their prices, but like, are they really their prices? Because they've like dropped their prices a lot over the years, you know, like it's something that, you know, Paul and I have always, we've raised our prices slowly over the last 13 years. And, but we've always stayed pretty much honestly very stuck on those prices. And I think because of that, we have more of a reputation with our relationships, either planners or whoever, photographers or whoever it may be, that like, these are their prices. Like they demand their full rate, you know, and that's only because like, we know that we've done things less risky and we've made the slow moves and we know that we're worth it. And we're open. We know that our yearbook's out every single year. So yeah, just, you know, looking inward on your own personal, you know, situation and, you know, making smart business decisions because of that.
Yeah. I would also say like, I think it's okay in these seasons to like change your prices frequently. So like maybe instead of just raising your prices by like $400 for all of 2024, like you do those small changes, but as you book, you change them more frequently. Like that feels like a safer way to test the market and see like how things are being perceived and how your value is being translated to the marketplace, while also not like being too scared, but not too risky. I don't know. I feel like that would be probably a good option for you.
Yeah. I guess another way to phrase the question would be, is it okay or is it frowned upon to charge 10,000 plus when your portfolio doesn't back it up? If everything mm-hmm. else like showcases that you have that type of brand and that you're confident in yourself, but if your portfolio doesn't show it, is it frowned upon?
Well, it depends on how big the gap is. I think that everyone who books their very first five-figure wedding did it without having five-figure weddings in their portfolio, right? So if your best wedding is like a backyard barn wedding with paper tablecloths and hay bales, then like maybe not. But if your best one is like very, very close or like kind of in that like high lovely range, like maybe the client spent $100,000 on the event for 100 people or something like that. You know what I mean? Then I think that there's a chance. And this is where being really choosy and what you want to show, right? Showcasing those best moments and hiding the things that are less than ideal will help you too. But I mean, everyone books their first $10,000 one without having a $10,000 one in their portfolio, right? So I think that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I think we got through all the ones that we can get to today. Again, there were so many others. If we didn't get to your question and you're listening and you asked either on Instagram or Facebook, please know that we would love to get to your question in future episodes. So keep checking back and we will eventually get to you, we promise. I'd like to just open up this to the alumni that we have here with us. I hope that you guys have enjoyed too as listeners, hearing, you know, additional questions that our alumni have and, or just, you know, things that they want to add. Everything's been so incredibly valuable. And we have loved having you all too in previous masterminds. You know, just, it's just so fun. We love it so much. So if you guys have any other things that you want to say or questions that you have, we would love to open it up to you guys.
Maybe we'll give Bruce the first right of refusal since he hasn't asked a question yet and he hasn't been on a podcast yet. Alex, I would say you, but you had your own episode. So we'll save you for next. So do you have anything, Bruce, for us?
Oh, I do. I do have one small question. I mean, honestly, like any question I ever have, like I honestly just refer to like the mastermind, like, you know, modules and stuff. So I'm like, wait, how do I do this again? Or, you know, like, how do I gradually increase my prices? Or how do I get in with these planners? Like, I always just like refer to any module I have. So, but I do have a question in regards to, so vertical video is just becoming like more and more of a thing. I hate it. I said I should make a shirt. I think I saw a hat. It said, make video horizontal again. And I love that hat. I need to cop that hat, seriously. But I got to get with the times. So I'm thinking, like, when we're shooting these weddings, and even with like our professional cameras, not just like a cell phone, are we framing for vertical? You know what I mean? Like, are we just shooting everything center and like throwing like a 35 on there? Is that what everyone's doing now? Or I don't know.
Yeah, I love that.
I like to frame like Wes Anderson style. Like, I like off center, but now I'm just like, you know, I just kind of have to like center everything. So,
yeah, I don't love vertical. I love the way that people enjoy it on Instagram more than I love how it looks. I will say I do enjoy vertical a little bit more when I do flip my camera vertical for certain shots. Like, I'm like, oh man, photographers, they have it made like this. You, I think we've all been in situations where we're shooting portraits alongside a photographer and they get the couple in this like certain spot and you're like, this is not translating like horizontally, right? You know, everyone over here is not like shaking their head if you're watching on YouTube. So I've taken those opportunities too to, yes, my first priority is to film it horizontally because I want the option to use it in their final product, in their film. But then, you know, we'll spend a little bit of time there. And then I'm like, okay, let me go ahead and flip my camera vertically. And a lot of times I'm like, oh yeah, I can see what the photographer's seeing and this is so much better. And I can use that specifically for, you know, within an Instagram teaser that I'm putting together, more of an aesthetic reel, if that makes sense. Taylor, what about you?
I have never not once flipped my camera vertically. No, really? Times. Zero times. Yeah. Here's what I do. I know like about myself that I typically film like way more punched in than I ever should, even for horizontal. So I just like take a second and I zoom out if I'm on my like 18 to 35, or I take a few steps back and I shoot more at different like distances and different focal lengths than I probably would, just to make sure, because in my brain I can like envision how that vertical crop is going to look on the screen, but like you're never going to be totally accurate even if you use like that grid, you know, that's available on an, like on your screen. So like I try to like err on the side of caution if I have time for it, otherwise like it's just like, whoops, that didn't look as exactly how I wanted it, but I'm going to just hope that my audience didn't know what I was going for and they're gonna think it looks fine even if it's not exactly what I planned. But yeah, it can be rough. I actually really like the way things look vertically. Like sometimes I'll like the way my teasers look better than my like horizontal films. I think I've like totally brainwashed into vertical videos from like too many hours on TikTok maybe. But that's how I do it, and just like shoot wider than you think you would. And I don't know, like speaking to the centered thing, like I don't shoot everything centered. I just will readjust like the framing, like in post.
Yeah.
Me too. That's okay.
I will go ahead and just, there's the auto reframe, right? In Premiere, if we have any Premiere people here, there's the auto reframe sequence where you can auto reframe it to a 9x16. And then now my dog's drinking water. We're just going to leave this in. It's like all part of it. So yeah, so basically I will do that, but then I'll go in and further adjust to make sure that I'm like moving the frame over. So Gabrielle, did you have a question and we didn't get to you? Did you raise your hand and we forgot to call?
No, I was going to talk about the reframing, which you absolutely got to. So perfect.
Yeah. What do you edit on?
I edit on Final Cut. So with Final Cut, you crop first and then you can like slide it over pretty easily. Yeah, it's super smooth.
That's so what I do. Mm-hmm.
Lots of reframing for sure, because shooting everything center would be hard.
Yeah.
And boring. Yeah.
Probably boring. But I will say, or go ahead, Bruce, did you have something?
I was going to say, I think like if you're like recentering and zooming in, maybe shooting 4K is like just a thing you have to do now, because versus like if you shot in 1080p and you're trying to reframe, now it's like the quality of your video drops. So it does. I mean, that could be another, you know.
Yeah. And that's what pushed me, like I said, into 4K was the vertical. And, you know, guys, as we're looking at things, there are just certain things that kind of ping you as a mainstream videographer or photographer. Right now we're talking specifically to videographers, but to me, I like the behavior of a mainstream filmmaker or someone who's not shooting premiere or luxury tier quality events are the ones that are still posting horizontally or trying to do the like flip your phone and then watch it. Like to me, like it shouts to me where, and not to say that I want to be like pinging people. It's just that it's almost like using HoneyBook, right? So like when someone uses HoneyBook for their, and we could also go way into this and we talk about this a lot in Mastermind. I know there's probably a lot of people listening here that are like, what's wrong with HoneyBook? And we could just go way into this. But when a planner sees that a filmmaker or photographer is using HoneyBook, it automatically just, there's assumptions brought on about the level of events that they shoot. Taylor, is this too harsh? Am I being like too mean?
No. I think we need more harsh, Kelly. I just want to leave, maybe this can just be like a little ribbon on this conversation. Those who adapt quickly rise to the top. And if you are a stick in the mud and fighting what people are gravitating more towards as our industry progresses and as the world progresses in terms of technology, like you're going to be left behind. So adapt or die, honestly, is kind of how it works if you want to rise to the top. And because you're listening to this podcast, I kind of assume you want to. So that's where we're going to leave it. But we are hitting like over an hour on this podcast. I think this is our longest podcast we've ever had. So we're going to call it there. But you guys, thank you so much for tuning in on this episode. It was such a special one with our alumni members. And for all of your questions, for those of you who asked, and like Kelly said earlier, if we didn't get to your question, we will be answering it on a future episode, maybe sprinkled in here or there randomly. So maybe not a dedicated Q&A. So, be sure to tune in weekly to hear if we answer your question. And yeah, it was such a joy. Thank you guys.
Thank you for joining us in this conversation. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us reach more filmmakers just like you by taking a screenshot and sharing it on social media. Don't forget to tag us at The Level Up Co.
And join us again next week, same time, same place, as we continue to level up the industry together.